This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, the mood is just, you can find that, there's joy, happiness everywhere, especially, from the contesting candidates and civil society organizations and the general public.
That was reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar about the latest regarding delayed elections in Senegal. Details coming up also. President Joe Biden tonight gives the annual State of the Union speech. And the United States is deeply concerned by reports of targeted civilian killings in Ethiopia. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. President Joe Biden tonight gives the annual State of the Union speech and address each president gives to Congress and other members of the government, including cabinet members. Presidents use this national broadcast speech to highlight accomplishments over the past year and to build support for new policies. Because this is an election year, with Biden expected to face former President Donald Trump in the November vote, the speech will likely draw extra attention. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell is on the phone line with me now to give us a preview of the speech, which begins at 9 p.m. Washington time or 0200 UTC. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Anita.
Good morning, Yehes.
Could you start by setting the scene for the speech? What preparations are going on now and who will be there?
Sure. Well, until Tuesday of this week, President Biden was at Camp David with his close advisors writing, revising the speech, which we expect this revision process to continue up until the moment he takes the stage, basically, because there's so many elements in play, so much changing, evolving news in the world. In terms of who's going to be there, I'm focused on the First Lady's box, and she is highlighting a number of the president's domestic priorities. She's bringing, for example, the Texas mother who experienced the consequences of that state's abortion ban and nearly died because she had a pregnancy that was not sustainable. She's bringing the head of the largest union in the country to highlight President Biden's economic goals and his support for union labor. She's bringing the prime minister of Sweden. That's because Sweden was recently officially admitted to the NATO alliance. So she's highlighting a number of priorities, but they all are in line with many of the priorities that President Biden himself is expected to outline in this about hour-long speech.
Okay, let's talk about the president's priorities. Has the White House signaled what President Biden intends to emphasize in the speech, which comes as he is running for re-election?
They sure have. Yesterday, John Kirby, he is basically one of the White House's top spokesmen, he told us that the president's going to focus on things like the economy. We've also heard that the president's going to talk about immigration and the situation at the southern border, his view that reproductive rights need to be protected in the United States. And also, Kirby told us that the president is going to focus on, quote, restoring American leadership on the world stage. We expect him, of course, to talk about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and Gaza, and to exhort members of the House of Representatives to vote on a proposal to put in about $95 billion worth of funding that includes significant funding for both of those conflicts.
And lastly, Anita, the opposition Republican Party will give a rebuttal to Biden's speech. Who will be doing that, and what is that speech expected to focus on?
Sure. The party has chosen Katie Britt of Alabama. She's the youngest woman in the Senate. She's just 42. Of course, that is going to provide a foil to Biden's age being 81, which is a big concern for voters. Britt is a Trump loyalist, calls herself a conservative Christian, and she's expected to address things like reproductive rights. As we know, Alabama recently had a court ruling where they determined that embryos are at the same status as babies. So she's expected to discuss those themes. She's expected to present what has now become kind of the expected Republican stance on issues like border security and immigration, economic growth, taxation. And I'm not sure what she's going to say about foreign policy, but she has expressed some concerns over funding in Ukraine and support for Israel.
VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
VOA Africa will run a live stream of the speech, and we will have a special radio coverage over most of our regular frequencies. Senegal's President Macky Sall has set a new election date, March 24th, but the Constitutional Council says it should be March 31st. Either date will be about a month after the original day of February the 25th, which Sall postponed, and also before the end of Sall's term in office on April 2nd. Earlier today, I spoke with reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar about the latest developments.
Yes, exactly. Senegalese President Macky Sall has scheduled a delayed presidential election for March 24th. The government said on yesterday after a top court ruled that a proposal to hold the vote after his mandate expires on April the 2nd will be unconstitutional. And in this case, the Constitutional Council earlier set March 31st to hold the elections. And then during a cabinet meeting, Macky Sall also set March 24th. So right now, the latest news is that the Constitutional Council, they had convened yesterday to see whether they will validate President Macky Sall's date. That's the 24th of March, 24th of this month, because so many people are saying the 31st of March or March, the end of March will just coincide with the Christian Easter holidays.
So basically, there is some confusion on the precise date of the first round vote, but President Macky Sall, like you said, went for March 24th, and the constitutional body wants it to take place on March 31st. Either way, the election would happen before Sall's mandate ends on April 2nd, which was one of the key drivers of the turmoil, right?
Exactly, and that is exactly what the Constitutional Council had in mind. That's the reason why they even rejected the proposals or the recommendations from the 2 days national dialogue which Macky Sall convened just about a couple of weeks ago, in which it was recommended that elections will be held in June, but the Constitutional Council just scratched that, saying that elections could only be held before the expiry of President Macky Sall's mandate.
So, Alpha, the poll delay triggered, as you are aware, and since you are there, deadly protests in the traditionally stable West African country, with much of the opposition and civil society suspecting the president of trying to prolong his term in office. So how is the mood there after the latest announcement?
Well, the mood is just, you can find that, there's joy, happiness everywhere, especially, from the contesting candidates and civil society organizations and the general public. They said that, this is exactly what President Macky Sall should have done. There was no need of trying to extend his mandate, because the Constitutional Court have ruled that President Macky Sall cannot do that. So the mood is everybody is discussing, And apart from that, also President Macky Sall yesterday, he had a very busy schedule during his cabinet. He resolved the government and appoint a new prime minister, the Minister of the Interior, who is Maître Sidiki Kaba, who is now the head of the government. And he said that he has relieved the prime minister so that he can have time to go and campaign for the election, because his prime minister, Amadou Ba, is the presidential candidate for the ruling coalition APR party.
And lastly, Alpha, I want to ask you about the imprisoned opposition figure Osman Sonko. Sonko, who came in third in the 2019 presidential election, has been detained since July 2023 and was disqualified from this year's presidential race. So questions have swirled around whether an amnesty would be applied to Sonko. What is the news in that regard?
Well, the amnesty that was proposed, Macky Sall, has been, unanimously voted yesterday in Parliament. So we are yet to know whether the amnesty that has been voted yesterday will cover Mr. Sonko and his deputy, Basiru Jomaifai, who is the presidential candidate for the main opposition leader. That's Mr. Sonko's number two. He's still in prison, and then campaigning will kick off, this weekend.
That was Alpha Jallo. He talked to me from Dakar. The United States last week said that it was deeply concerned by reports of targeted civilian killings in the Ethiopian town of Marawi, located in the country's northern Amhara region. I spoke this week with David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, about what's been going on in Ethiopia. In part two of our conversation, he says there are also calls to independently investigate drone attacks and extrajudicial killings by government forces on civilians. Professor Monda starts out our conversation by describing Prime Minister Abiy's political transformation.
Yes, it's completely transforming and not in a good way. In addition to the killings you mentioned in the Amhara region in Merowe, we also have more recent killings in the capital of the Amhara region in Bahir Dar. And there have been calls for investigations for these extrajudicial killings of civilians, for the use of drones in these extrajudicial killings. But the challenge here is there's very few, if any, independent observers in those regions to actually find out what's happening. So if there's any investigation, it's going to be done by the Ethiopian government. So the Ethiopian government's going to be investigating itself, which raises its own challenges about the results of that investigation. I might also add, there's been a recent criticism of the Africa Union about its silence on some of these extrajudicial killings in Ethiopia. We recently had the heads of government meeting in Ethiopia, and nothing was said about these challenges within Ethiopia and about the challenges of the Africa Union infrastructure, the Peace and Security Committee, the Standby Force, and even just African heads of state standing up and speaking out against these extrajudicial killings.
Why the silence?
Because most of the leaders from the continent, unfortunately, are also engaged in the same kind of extrajudicial killings in their own countries. And, it would be very hypocritical for the majority of them who are engaged in what the killings Prime Minister Abiy is engaged in Ethiopia, to criticize him when they themselves are undemocratic and are also engaged in extrajudicial killings of minority groups. They're engaged in taking over power through unconstitutional means, or even in these murders and abductions. So this is why it becomes a problem for them to criticize Ethiopia on some of its human rights abuses.
So what happens as we move forward as far as the security for not only Ethiopia, but the whole Horn Africa region?
I think this is a very important question, because the way forward is really challenging. Ethiopia's problems did not start in 2024. These are historical pre-colonial issues that will really have to be settled by enlightened leadership going forward. I do not feel that the conflicts in Ethiopia can be settled entirely using military force. There has to be some form of way, either confederation, power sharing, negotiation, reconciliation of a lot of the massacres from the past going forward. There'll need to be a lot of investment in diplomatic infrastructure and also in early warning systems within the country to raise red flags when particular regions are facing problems. But as we know, Ethiopia is, as we've said, is the second largest population in Africa. It's a very mountainous country. So if the government's going to use military force to try and bring down some of these groups, it's virtually impossible because your opponents can hide in the mountains and launch guerrilla attacks for long, long periods. And it's ultimately the civilians who will suffer. So I really think it needs the Africa Union intervention from outside, but also major powers putting some pressure on the Ethiopian government to settle some of these disputes. But I think we also need more transformative leadership from Prime Minister Abiy, because this use of brute military force anytime there's any kind of problem in the country, I think is very counterproductive for Ethiopia and for the sub-region.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York. He talked to me from New York. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Russian influence in Africa is expanding on many levels. Diplomatically, experts say Russia's goal is to gain more support for its vision of a multipolar world order based on weakened Western influence. At the United Nations, it lobbies African allies for favorable votes on issues like the Ukraine conflict and works to sow distrust with UN peacekeeping missions and other multilateral efforts. David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what the U.S. should do to confront these Russian goals.
What Russia seeks to do is, their vision is, they want to have a world where there are spheres of influence. So they recognize that the Western Hemisphere is mostly an American sphere of influence. They're perfectly happy with East Asia being a Chinese-dominated sphere of influence. And they feel that the Eurasia continent, to include everything that was part of the former Soviet Union and Soviet Pact, is a Russian sphere of influence. So they want to reestablish that sort of along Cold War lines. And they view Africa as the only place that's really kind of up for grabs. So they see themselves as being able to leverage first off their veto in the UN, and then providing, working with African countries, most of which have serious issues with corruption. They're able to use levers that are not available to politicians in true, open, accountable democracies in order to leverage these international institutions. The benefit of this from a Russian perspective is that people in the West and indeed around the world tend to view these multinational institutions as more virtuous than national institutions. So this is a way to enhance Russian prestige. The U.S. And the other democracies are at a disadvantage because, quite frankly, we can't give these countries stuff. And more importantly, we can't give corrupt leaders of many of these countries stuff the way the Russians can. We can't do it on the time scale. We can't do it in many instances just because what the leaders want is illegal, but the Russians can. So this is going to require a sustained involvement. And quite frankly, the Western engagement with Africa has been intermittent. I think we need to think about that and have a sustained presence on our terms, not just building whatever the ruler of the day wants, but it really does require a commitment to African development, and that has not been sustained or long-term.
In what's considered by many experts an existential challenge to Africa, Russian disinformation operations across West Africa have led to an unprecedented rise in popular support for Russia, citizen demands for Russian interventions, and in some cases, new military partnerships between African countries and Russia. What's your take on that?
This again requires us to have people more involved in the media, people, who call it out from the start. I mean, look, Russian disinformation in Africa has been going on for three generations. And there are a lot of things that Russia, has put out there. They have an established playbook. They have a global footprint. So, they'll get something published in an Indian newspaper and then trot that around, you know, different African countries. A lot of these things are persistent, like AIDS was invented in a laboratory in the United States, or allegations of organ harvesting of orphans, things like this. We have kind of seeded. We don't really have people who push back aggressively against this because we tend to regard these things as ridiculous, or we just have an almost naive confidence that truth will eventually out itself. But what we really need to do is revitalize an agency we used to have, the U.S. Information Services, and consciously recognize that we're in a conflict here for influence, that the intellectual sphere is a domain of global power competition, and that we've kind of left it unaddressed. I don't know if that will happen, though, in the short term, given that we're obsessed with other more near-term issues.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University here in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. The United Nations is criticizing the reported mass abduction of over 200 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in Nigeria's Borno state last week. The UN Office for the Coordinator of Humanitarian Affairs in Nigeria said the incident occurred while the victims, mostly women and children residing in government-run camps, went into the forest in search of firewood. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The UN Nigeria resident and humanitarian coordinator, Mohamed Malik Fall, released a statement condemning the abduction and called for the immediate release of the victims. The majority of the victims were women living in camps in Gamboru, Ngala town, near Nigeria's border with Cameroon and Chad. Fall said the incident, just days ahead of the International Women's Day commemoration, was a reminder that women and girls are among the most impacted by conflict. He also called on Nigerian authorities to provide more job opportunities to IDPs within their camps so they don't have to venture out and expose themselves to gangs and terrorists. According to local media reports, details of the abductions are only emerging now due to the deliberate damage of telecommunications lines in the area by terrorists. Security analyst Kabir Adamu says he has been monitoring the situation.
It started filtering in early in the week. At the first instance, we had about 139, and then later 350. It wasn't just one camp. Camp, it was about three camps. And so this difficulty in terms of identifying the exact numbers of persons affected. But we know the state government has set up a response team, an emergency response team, and that team is out there.
Neither the Borno State government nor federal authorities have commented on the kidnappings, and there has been no claim of responsibility. Borno State is where the Boko Haram insurgency was launched in 2009. This week, the state government said 95% of Boko Haram terrorists are either dead or have surrendered to authorities. Adamu says the claims may be true, but notes that many parts of Borno remain insecure.
At the last count, over 80,000 of the families and members of this group have surrendered either to the Nigerian military or to the Borno state government. So yes, successes are being made, but what would call overall success unfortunately haven't been met. And number one is the ability of the government to stop this group from generating funding. I don't think the Nigerian state has done enough.
Nigeria's police force of about 300,000 is controlled by the federal government. But for the first time, the government and Nigeria's 36 states are seeking to create state police units. Security analyst Mike Ijeofa says that would be a step in the right direction.
We need to adopt new measures. That's why I was excited when the president and the governors, you know, backed the establishment of the state police. You know, security challenges are local, so we must look for local solutions. The Nigerian police is too centralized to be effective.
However, the plan for state police units has critics who say officials could use officers for ulterior motives. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yuhayus Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.